Hello and welcome to this GCP short, produced in partnership with TMF Group and all about the tax considerations for non-US captives writing insurance in the United States. Over the next 22 minutes, I am joined by US-based tax attorney Asher Harris and Joseph Fimbo, IPT Assurance Director at TMF. Asher and Joe address the relevant IPT, federal excise and other taxes relevant for captives doing business in the United States, the impact of using different domiciles and closing agreements. For more information on TMF Group and their captive services, visit their Friend of the Podcast page on the Captive Intelligence website. There are links in the episode show notes. So, Asher, can you start by telling us what IPT and other taxes are relevant and need to be considered when we are discussing non-US domicile captives doing business in the United States?
Sure. Thank you, Richard. The key taxes are really the federal taxes that captives have to be aware of. And the United States imposes an excise tax on insurance premiums paid on U.S. risks that are paid to non-U.S. reinsurers. Rates are 4% for direct insurance, 1% for reinsurance. And the major issue with respect to captives is that there are specific waivers in certain tax treaties that allow the tax not to be paid. So if the captive is in a domicile that qualifies for the treaty waiver, and the captive itself qualifies for the is eligible for the treaty exemption, then the tax does not have to be paid. So one of the things that a non-U.S. captive has to think about is whether or not it's treaty eligible. Most captive domiciles are not treaty eligible. The two major European domiciles that do have tax treaties with the United States that call for the waiver are Ireland and Luxembourg. Channel Islands obviously does not. Malta does not. Luxembourg is a little bit tricky because the treaty only applies to direct insurance and not reinsurance, so you'd have to be a little bit careful if you have a Luxembourg captive that's reinsuring a U.S. captive. The other thing that you have to be careful about in terms of treaty eligibility is making sure that the captive satisfies what's called the limitation on benefits clauses of the tax treaties. Virtually all United States tax treaties have two tests in order for a company to be eligible for the benefits of the treaty. One is a residence test, and the other is what's referred to typically as a limitations on benefits clause. The residence test is fairly straightforward. If you're organized in a particular country, you're a resident of that country, so you know pretty easily whether or not that test is met. The limitations on benefits clauses are more diverse. They vary from treaty to treaty, and they're really intended to combat what the United States views as treaty shopping, where a company located in a non-treaty country may set up a subsidiary in a treaty country that has a very limited business contact with that. So, for example, if you have a non-treaty parent and it sets up a subsidiary in a treaty country such as Ireland, but there's no real business contact with Ireland, then that Irish subsidiary may fail the limitations on benefits clauses. The limitations on benefits clauses are typically fairly complex. They have a whole number of choices, so you can satisfy the clause if you meet any of them, but you have to go through it very carefully to make sure that the captive qualifies.
Can you expand then a bit, Asher, on federal excise taxes and explain kind of when this is applicable for captives providing insurance in the U.S.?
It applies when the premium is paid from the United States to the foreign captive. It applies at the applicable rate of 4% or 1%, and it applies on any risks that are located within the United States. So you really have to look at the location of the risk and carefully analyze, first of all, whether the risk is located in the United States, and depending on the types of coverages that are placed within the captive, that may not be so simple to figure out. And then obviously there are also often premium allocation issues if it's part of a global program that covers risks in various countries.
And certainly when you're thinking about the multinational programs, when you do have risks in multiple countries, that's when you find the real difficulty in working out. And actually, there's not a great deal of guidance from the IRS on this, how much of the premium should be considered US premium. And the differences that you have when your main subscribing policyholder is or is not in the US. So a single policy for a single US entity in a single state for a single US risk, nice and easy, fine. But when you have multiple risks across the US and then outside of the US as well, with various different entities being covered under that policy, under that program, that the clarity on how much we should be considering US premium can get a bit tricky to determine, I think.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct, Joe. And I think that that's one of the recurring issues in insurance premium tax is the question of allocation of premium, both between insureds as well as between different types of coverages that may have different rates. I think that in Europe, there's a more broader spectrum of rates that are applicable to different types of insurance. In the with respect to federal excise tax, it's typically 4% on direct, 1% on reinsurance, 1% on life, but life is typically fairly easy to distinguish. But that question of how to take a single premium and divide it up and allocate it among the various insureds in the various lines of business can be quite complex.
And that will also conflict potentially with the other taxes that we're not necessarily thinking about, say the self-procurement taxes, which will the allocation there will be on a completely different, basis of rules to consider where to allocate the premium. And so you've got two sets of rules to be thinking. Just because your self-procurement taxes is saying I've got all my tax to be paid in one state, that does not necessarily mean that you can therefore consider all your premium to be subject to FET.
That's absolutely correct. And I think it's a really good point. As you said, we're not really going to get into great detail into state self-procurement taxes here, but in the area of self-procurement taxes, it's driven by the allocation, so that the company that has the largest allocation of premium under a specific policy will then have a great deal of premium subject to tax within the state that then becomes the home state. So in that context, can be really binary, where having the largest allocation of premium to that company can really sort of flip the switch for not only that company, but for a number of other companies as well that are under the same program. When it comes to federal excise tax, it's more a question of allocation between the entities. But I think, as you say, if you've got, for example, a company that has property in the United States and Germany, you'd obviously want to be careful that the allocation to the United States is consistent with the manner that it's being done, because the German tax authorities may have other opinions about the appropriate risk allocation.
On the federal excise tax then, and the kind of different exemptions and things that you've spoken through, how does all that impact reinsurance arrangements in captive programs?
When it comes to reinsurance agreements, it can get quite tricky. There's a number of companies, especially larger companies, that may have multiple captives in various jurisdictions. One of the features of the federal excise tax is that it typically only applies to the extent that the risk is not then reinsured to a company organized in a country that does not benefit from treaty benefits. So that if you have a company that has one captive in a qualifying jurisdiction, let's say Ireland, and the Irish captive then reinsures to a second captive in a non-qualifying jurisdiction, let's say Bermuda, for example, that second leg of reinsurance, when it's ceded by the Irish entity to the Bermuda entity, would then break the eligibility on the first leg for the benefits of the treaty, so that the company has to track how much of the risk that is written by the captive that qualifies for treaty benefits, how much of that is retained in that jurisdiction, how much of it is ceded to other captives or other reinsurers who don't qualify for treaty benefits, and how much of it is ceded to other reinsurers who may in fact benefit from the treaty
exemption. This is always baffled me as a piece of compliance, because compliance is about certainty and it's about getting things right. How on earth does anybody ever know that 4, 5, 6 links down the chain, the sum of that premium may leave a treaty country into a non-treaty country, and then all the way back down the chain, you've got to have a look at that first one to say, okay, now you've got to pay tax.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very tricky to figure that out, and one of the logistical ways to address that situation is through closing agreements. But one of the other compliance issues is sort of audit risks that you raise is what does it even mean to talk about what percentage of risk is reinsured to a non-qualifying country, because premiums specifically relate to a specific risk, whereas reinsurance can be facultative or treaty. In its audit guidelines, the IRS typically just looks at what proportion of the inbound premiums that are written by a captive are then ceded out to another third party. So they don't really distinguish between facultative and treaty. They don't seem to have understood the distinction. So basically what the IRS would do is they would say, okay, if you have an Irish captive and it writes $100 of premium and it cedes $50 of reinsurance to a Bermuda captive, they will assume that 50 cents of every dollar has been ceded out, and therefore that the treaty has been broken with respect to half of the premiums written by that Irish captive, regardless of the source of the premiums, because obviously that Irish captive could be writing insurance in a number of jurisdictions in addition to the United States.
So you mentioned closing agreements before. Can you tell us a bit more about those, what they are, and why they are useful to be aware of?
One thing that's interesting about the closing agreements is that I think many people within the industry think that the closing agreement brings about or causes the treaty exemption, and it really doesn't. It's really just a sort of logistical technique that's used to confirm that the insurer is eligible for treaty benefits. So it's really confirmation rather than effecting the exemption from FET. But it really goes to the question that Joe just referred to, which is how do you know, as an insured, how do you know whether your insurer is retaining the risk, ceding it to another qualifying insurer, or ceding it to a non-qualifying reinsurer? So in the closing agreement, the insurer enters into what's essentially a contract with the Internal Revenue Service, under which it agrees to monitor its compliance with the treaty, to report to the IRS on a quarterly basis how much of its U.S. risks have been retained and how much have been ceded to non-qualifying reinsurers. And it also agrees to pay any resulting excise tax that comes about as a result of that cession. So that as an insurer, if a U.S. insured buys insurance from a foreign insurer that purports to be eligible under a treaty for FET exemption, if that company has a closing agreement, then that relieves the duty of compliance from the U.S. company from then wondering whether the subsequent cessions are within the treaty network or outside of the treaty network. So it really addresses the compliance issue that Joe just referred to. One of the things that it does do, however, is that it forces the insurance company to monitor whether or not the company that it's buying insurance from does have a closing agreement. So even though it doesn't actually trigger the exemption from FET, it not only evidences, but it shifts the compliance burden from the insured to the insurer. And because of that, as a practical matter, it comes in very handy in allowing insureds to know that they're not subject to FET on the insurance that they purchase.
Is there benefit then in the captive in a treaty country having that? Because it sounds like a lot more work for the captive, you know, plenty more filings that they're going to have to be doing, all this reporting, when the transaction ultimately up to that captive is going to be one that might go out to a fronting insurer but then come back into the captive in, say, Ireland.
A lot of companies do find that it's helpful for the captive to have the closing agreement in place, because it just sort of enables them, first of all, to confirm that the exemption is in place. So it's sort of a good source of self-discipline to ensure that, for example, the limitations of benefits clauses is satisfied, so that the closing agreement has to be applied for through the IRS. The IRS examines the situation and verifies that the recipient is eligible for treaty benefits. And it also has to be renewed or refreshed every 3 years, so that it just kind of forces the company to make sure that that they've done what they need to do in order to make sure that the company that thinks that it's treaty eligible actually has met all of the applicable requirements. So it's helpful in that sense. Even if an insurance transaction is fully internal, in the sense that the only insureds are related parties, typically it turns out to be a helpful discipline to go through.
You touched on it at the beginning, Asher, but in terms of how, regarding closing agreements, this all varies depending on captive domicile as well. Is it similar to what you said before? You know, how does it compare, you know, Guernsey compared to Luxembourg, or Malta or Dublin compared to Bermuda, for example?
So countries like the Channel Islands or Gibraltar aren't eligible for the treaty with the US-UK. Tax treaty. The Isle of Man isn't eligible. Malta, there is a tax treaty between the United States and Malta, but it doesn't have a FET waiver. So Bermuda, currently there's no treaty in effect, so that if FET is important, basically the only captive domiciles that are really relevant are Ireland and Luxembourg. But even there, you have to make sure that the limitations on benefits clauses are met. Typically, in most cases, a subsidiary of a European Union country is eligible for, has basically satisfied the limitations on benefits clause, so that if you have a French or a German company that has a Luxembourg captive, typically they're okay on the limitations on benefits clause. But if UK companies, I think, have a little bit more struggle now post-Brexit, as well as other non-EU countries, have to be a little bit more concerned with whether or not they satisfy the limitations on benefits clauses.
So in terms of, Joe touched on it earlier about compliance, obviously compliance is pretty important, most important part of all of this really. Where does compliance and filing responsibilities lie, and how should captives and captive owners ensure that they are in full compliance?
I think that's really one of the Achilles heels of this whole area, because I think that a lot of companies just sort of assume that if they believe that they're treaty eligible, that they are. And certainly having a closing agreement makes it clear that you are eligible. But even if you don't have a closing agreement, or in fact even if you do have a closing agreement, there's still quite a bit of reporting that needs to be done. There needs to be quarterly reporting done to the IRS confirming that have not been any outbound reinsurance sessions that would trigger FET. There's outbound reinsurance that is to a reinsurer that qualifies for treaty benefits. The treaty benefits still have to be claimed on a form that has to be filed, depending on the specifics, either quarterly or annually. And there's quite stiff penalties for taking advantage of a treaty without reporting it. So I think, as I said before, compliance is one of the areas where I think the captive industry could improve its game a little bit, and just making sure that all of the required filings have been done and have been accounted for, because they actually are not that complicated. All you have to do is fill in the amounts of premiums. It just has to be done. It has to be taken care of, so that there has to be somebody who has the responsibility for ensuring that the compliance obligations are met. If there is outbound reinsurance that's ceded to a reinsurer that purports itself to be eligible for treaty benefits, then you have to make sure that confirming whether that company has a closing agreement, or if not, there are other compliance burdens that may kick in.
And if you're paying out to a captive, out of the US to a captive that is definitely not in a treaty company, so FET will apply, that 4% or that 1% is going to apply. I think that something pretty key here is the communication between all the parties, to make sure it's really clear who is paying, because the law is not explicit as far as I can see. The guidance is fairly vague. Practice is it tends to be the party that's paying out of the US. So if it's a a US insured paying directly to, say, a Bermuda captive, it would be that US insured that would typically be responsible for doing it. But there's nothing to stop the IRS pursuing the captive. If it's going through a fronting arrangement, so US insured to a US carrier, and the carrier is then reinsuring it out, then the carrier is typically going to be the one. But these things need to be ironed out and understood so that it's not like, well, I thought you were doing it, or no, but surely you're doing it, right? And yeah, and then nobody's done it.
Those tasks that everybody assumes somebody else yeah. is doing or taking care of are the ones that fall between the cracks. As we've said before, the federal excise tax on insurance premiums paid to foreign insurers is one of the oldest taxes in the United States. It was enacted in the post-civil in the late 19th century to help pay off the money that the United States had borrowed to fight the Civil War. And it was originally enacted such that the insurance policy itself had to have a stamp on it. In order for the policy to be legally binding within the United States, you would have to go to the post office, buy a stamp in the appropriate amount, and physically affix it to the policy in order for it to have legal validity. And that was only changed, I think, in the 1960s, actually, where we went from a stamp that was affixed to the policy to a quarterly return. And even some of the regulations that are in place have never really been, they've been updated, but they haven't really been thought through as to how the federal excise tax should really work in a situation where it's being done on a quarterly return basis as opposed to a policy by policy basis. So some of the vagueness that you referred to is just due to the fact that there was a transition. It was done a certain way for close to 100 years, and then when they shifted, they didn't really do a great job of updating the regulations to provide for that shift. But because of that, you're absolutely right. Technically speaking, anybody who at least has any responsibility for ensuring that the tax is paid has at least some degree of responsibility and can be tagged with a liability if the other parties involved in the transactions don't come through or disappear or go insolvent without ensuring that the tax is paid.
We actually still have in Europe stamp duties, which still require the stamps. So, I mean, that's a different podcast. But yeah, the US might be a bit ahead of some parts of Europe there.
When I started out as a lawyer, we used to occasionally have to send paralegals or administrative assistants to the bank to buy those stamps for either federal excise tax or New York State stock tax. But I don't think very many in the United States, at the very least, we no longer have physical stamps affixed to physical documents very much anymore.
Great. Well, thank you both for coming on to the Global Captive Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.